attack that he's now willing to testify, according to two letters obtained by the New York Times. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Luke Broadwater and Maggie Haberman. The piece is titled, Bannon Facing Jail and Fines Agrees to Testify to January 6th Panel. With his criminal trial for contempt of Congress approaching, Stephen K. Bannon, an ally of former President Donald Trump, who was involved in his plans to overturn the 2020 election, has informed the House committee investigating the Capitol attack that he's now willing to testify, according to two letters obtained by the New York Times. His decision is a remarkable about-face for Mr. Bannon, who until Saturday had been among the most obstinate and defiant of the committee's potential witnesses. He had promised to turn the criminal case against him into the misdemeanor from hell for the Justice Department. But with the possibility of 2 years in jail and large fines looming on the horizon, Steve Bannon has been authorized to testify by Donald Trump, his lawyer told the committee late on Saturday, 9th of July. The former president had previously instructed Steve Bannon and other associates not to cooperate with the House panel, claiming that executive privilege, a president's power to withhold certain internal executive branch information, especially confidential communications involving him or his top aides, compelled them to stay silent. But in recent days, as several witnesses have come forward to offer the House panel damning testimony about Donald Trump's conduct, Mr. Trump has grown frustrated that one of his fiercest defenders has not yet appeared before the committee, people close to him have said. Steve Bannon is willing to and indeed prefers to testify at your public hearing, Robert J. Costello, Mr. Bannon's lawyer, wrote to Representative Benny Thompson, Democrat of Mississippi, and the chairman of the House committee. Mr. Costello said that Steve Bannon's decision to comply with the committee's subpoena came after he was cleared to testify by Donald Trump. He provided the panel with a letter that Donald Trump sent to Steve Bannon on Saturday that waived any claim to executive privilege over his testimony or documents relevant to the subpoena. Our position about the committee remains unchanged, but President Trump wants Mr. Bannon to tell the committee the truth, Mr. Costello said on Sunday, 10th of July. He said Steve Bannon planned to supply the committee with documents as well as testimony. The House Committee and the Justice Department have long maintained that Donald Trump has no valid claim of executive privilege over Mr. Bannon's testimony, in part because Steve Bannon left the White House in 2017 and was a private citizen when he was involved in Mr. Trump's efforts to hold on to power after the 2020 presidential election. When you first received a subpoena to testify and provide documents, I invoked executive privilege, Donald Trump wrote in his letter to Steve Bannon on Saturday. However, I watched how unfairly you and others have been treated, having to spend vast amounts of money on legal fees and all of the trauma you must be going through for the love of your country and out of respect for the office of the president. Therefore, he continued, if you reach an agreement on a time and place for your testimony, I will waive executive privilege for you, which allows for you to go in and testify truthfully and fairly, as per the request of the Unselect Committee of Political Thugs and Hacks. Steve Bannon's trial on two counts of criminal contempt of Congress is set for 18th of July. Each count carries a penalty of up to a year in jail and a $100,000 fine. It remains to be seen how Steve Bannon's new posture will affect the criminal proceeding, and how forthcoming he will be. He could refuse to speak about certain topics, citing the Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination, as some other witnesses have done. But the committee has repeatedly said that it needs to hear from Steve Bannon and receive the documents it requested from him about plans to overturn the 2020 presidential election. We got the letter around midnight from his lawyer saying that he would testify, and we have wanted him to testify, Representative Zoe Lofgren, Democrat of California and a member of the House committee, told CNN on Sunday. Lofgren added, "So the committee, of course, has not yet had a chance to discuss it, but I expect that we will be hearing from him, and there are many questions that we have for him." Should Steve Bannon ultimately appear for an interview, he would give his testimony behind closed doors like the hundreds of other witnesses have done, Ms. Lofgren said. The committee has carefully choreographed its public hearings to make a streamlined presentation of its case and has worked to avoid public sparring sessions with witnesses. For months, Steve Bannon has been perhaps the most bombastic and strident potential witness the committee has called to testify. He refused to turn over a single document or sit for a minute of testimony. For his intransigence, the House voted in October to hold Steve Bannon in criminal contempt of Congress. But the panel has insisted that Mr. Bannon, Donald Trump's former chief strategist and counselor, could help investigators better understand the January 6, 2021 attack, which was meant to stop the certification of President Biden's victory. On his radio show on 5th of January 2021, Steve Bannon promised that all hell is going to break loose tomorrow, a statement that shows he had some foreknowledge about extreme events that would occur the next day, the committee said in a report. Investigators have also pointed to a conversation Steve Bannon had with Donald Trump on 30th of December 2020, in which he urged him to focus his efforts on 6th of January, the day that Congress was to make the official count of electoral votes to confirm Joe Biden's victory. Steve Bannon was also present at a meeting at the Willard Hotel in Washington the day before the violence, when plans were discussed to try and overturn the results of the election the following day. Steve Bannon's criminal case is just the latest against him. Federal prosecutors indicted and arrested him in 2020 in Manhattan, New York, on charges relating to money raised to promote the construction of the border wall, long sought by Donald Trump. But before facing trial, he was preemptively pardoned by Donald Trump just hours before the former president left office.
Economic Divide.
The recent BRICS meeting hosted by China was a big event. Five countries not only pledged closer ties, but the Chinese president even encouraged other countries to join the bloc. Iran and Argentina applied. As BRICS turned into a grouping that is against the West and its financial grip, from monetary systems to trade. Hi, I'm Kavit Ahwai, and that is just one of the angles we'll be covering in this edition of Economic Divide. Coming up in the program, the BRICS countries, 40% of the world's population, 26% of the global economy, and $27.5 trillion dollars in economic might. Next, we're going to take a look at the BRICS expansion As we just mentioned, Iran and Argentina have applied for membership. Also looking at emerging market alternative to the West. That is something that the Chinese President Xi Jinping has encouraged. And finally, one of the other highlights of today's program, China and Russia to have leveled criticism against Western and the U.S. abuse of sanctions, the Ukraine crisis, a wake-up call, warning against expanding military alliances.
The BRICS group of nations have just held the 14th summit hosted by China. The group, which owes its name to the initials of its five member states, namely Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. BRICS nations have a combined population of 3.23 billion, and the combined GDP is more than $23 trillion. China has by far the largest economy in the BRICS grouping, accounting for more than 70% of the group's collective economic might. India accounts for about 13%, with Russia and Brazil each accounting for about 7%. The group has attained more significance following the war in Ukraine. The group is now seen as an emerging bulwark against U.S. global hegemonic ambitions. The group is trying to boost multilateral cooperation with non-Western styles, forms, and principles.
The New Development Bank is present there in a whole range of sectors. I'll look, for example, our projects in wind energy in China, solar energy projects that we have in Brazil. We can say that the New Development Bank is contributing its share, closed the gap between the needs of infrastructure and sustainability in the emerging world and the resources that should be there available to finance these great projects.
The social media content on the BRICS countries was in some way even more than the actual media coverage, which shows how the West may be concerned about this grouping, which represents about 26% of the world's GDP. Well, first post is what the Chinese President Xi Jinping has said. Chinese President Xi Jinping on the 14th BRICS summit, it is important that BRICS countries support each other on issues concerning core interests, practice true multilateralism, safeguard justice, fairness, and solidarity, and reject hegemony, bullying, and division. Next up, BRICS countries certainly bring more positive, stabilizing, and constructive strength to the world. And a comparison was in this particular tweet, and stat-wise, it is apparent how BRICS outweighs the G7 group of countries, especially when it comes to the GDP. When you take a look at that, 26% versus 16%. And of course, the other stats speak for themselves in comparison. Next up, people are taking notice of the relevance of BRICS, given that the two countries have applied for membership, namely Iran and Argentina, which was covered in this tweet. So that shows that that's actually being recognized. And then moving on to this one, in the past 16 years, constantly have we heard that BRICS cannot be sustained. Time tells. And then it goes on to make a comparison between BRICS and security groupings. Here you can see BRICS standing for real multilateralism versus Cold War mentality, the security grouping, and then BRICS, how it focuses on global development versus the security grouping's focus on exploiting developing countries. And of course, the other factors, as you see here. All right, so that was that comparison. Let me introduce our guest for this edition of the program, Glenn Diesen. He's a professor of international relations at the University of Southeastern Norway, who joins us. Glenn Diesen, welcome. When you take a look at the BRICS countries, they are a major economic, obviously, force, accounting for 40% of the world's population and 26% of the global economy. Now, China, by far, has the largest economy in this grouping, leading the way, accounting for more than 70% of it. But other countries are hoping to do better. Russia and Brazil, for example, they each account for 7%, and that may increase. Do you think that the BRICS countries is making a huge comeback, given the fact that you're looking at the Ukraine conflict and some of the geopolitical shifts worldwide that's taking place?
It's that the reason it's become so relevant, that it's come back into this fold, is because it's a response to the unipolar order, which is becoming more and more unfeasible, and also declining. So the unipolar order is effectively the international economy organized around the United States and also the collective West. So what we've been seeing over the past few years is simply that there's an emergence of new technologies which are not in the West. You know, across this BRICS country, you have new industries, new transportation corridors, there's new banks, there's more use of local currencies. So BRICS kind of represents, it's a way of organizing, if you will, this new diversified economic connectivities.
All right, let me introduce our next guest, Kim Do-joo. He is a political analyst, a senior fellow at Pangol Institution. He's also adjunct professor at Renmin University of China, and he joins us from Beijing, China. Kim Do-joo, welcome. The Chinese president has actually criticized the abuse of international sanctions, in particular, obviously making reference to the U.S. there. The Ukraine crisis, he also added, is a wake-up call for the world. And he also warned against these expanding military alliances, which is obviously a reference to NATO. What do you think about how BRICS used to be viewed, its contribution to the world economy, and how that has increased, and now with the Ukraine conflict, perhaps it's more relevant, and showing how alignments are shifting towards the East, perhaps, in some sense?
Well, I think, you know, as a group, as I said, the more represent this balancing power, I would say, to this current international system, which is dominated by Washington and Brussels. This is not balanced. This is not not fair, let's say, to the to this developing world. So there's a need, there's a long-term need to be fairly represented and to govern the international community or international global governance, let's say. Reform to the global governance is necessary. And with the rise of the developing world, I think, of course, they will defend their interests, they will have their voice heard.
It's time now for the Infonews section of the program, where we take a look at economic news from around the world. Our first stop, Ghana. Ghana to make a U-turn and actually ask the IMF for help for its economy. Ghana had refused to seek the IMF support to rescue an economy that's been crippled by the pandemic, rampant inflation, and also a depreciating currency. Protests have actually gone against the government, and they've spiraled in some places out of control, in particular inflation, to have taken place also to lead to the protests. The growth has been slowed to 3.3% year-on-year, and inflation a record 27.6% for the month of May. Next up, recession alarm bells. Asia's manufacturing has slowed. That has added to the global recession fears. Factory activity slowing or declining in countries like Japan, South Korea, and in Taiwan amid supply disruptions and also rising costs. Now, China's manufacturing activity, here's the interesting part, expanded at its fastest pace in 13 months for the month of June as the lifting of COVID lockdowns sent factories racing to meet robust demand. Well, sharp economic slowdown risks in Europe, however, and then the United States, or maybe together at once, have reinforced fears of a global recession. So we can see how that is also gripping the world, what's happening in Europe and the States. Next up, we're going to take a look at ruble power. Yes, right, Russia demanding rubles for now grain exports. Moscow has expanded the list of commodities that must be paid for in the Russian currency. Obviously, the ruble is going to keep on doing better now that that has been added to the list. The Russian government has added also grain, sunflower oil, and it has extracted meal, a category that it calls, to the list of exports. Now, Russia is the world's largest wheat exporter and a major supplier of sunflower seeds. So still, the ramifications of the Ukraine conflict are at play. Our final stop in the U.S. and the stock markets there. Now, U.S. stocks are off to their worst start in over 50 years. The S&P 500, for example, ended first half of 2022 lower by 20.6%. Lots of losses there. And the Dow Jones has also been at the receiving end of the losses, down 15.3% this year, marking its worst first half performance since the year 1962, if you can believe that. Well, investors obviously are grappling with the risks of an economic downturn and also tighter monetary policy. Those are the four items that we picked.
You're listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
It's time now for our in-depth section of the program. Well, when it comes to the BRICS group of countries, there's certainly a union between these countries and how, as one, they present a powerful economic force, which contributes a lot to the world economy as a result. There's no doubts about that, along with other groupings, blocs, and alliances. Well, the BRICS countries, well, the numbers speak for themselves. The world population, 41%. The world GDP, 24%. That's how much they contribute to the world GDP. That's almost a quarter of the world GDP. In terms of the global GDP, the value, $24.44 trillion. And in terms of the world trade, 16% there. Also, the global economic growth is 50% that it has contributed to. And this block of countries comprised of five countries, two to have applied for membership, Iran and Argentina. Goldman Sachs, the powerful brokerage firm out of the U.S., has said BRICS can become bigger than the G7 by the year 2035. That's not that far away. So that shows how powerful this grouping of countries is. All right, let's move on to the next grouping of countries. It's called the EAEU or the EAU, the Eurasia Economic Union. It is comprised of five countries, all of them in a single market, of which it has 184 million people in that market. And the combined GDP is $5 trillion. So this group of countries is something to take a note of. Now, moving on next, the SCO, Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Now, when you take a look at the SCO, this is the world's largest regional organization in terms of the numbers that it stands for of the countries. The land mass itself is pretty evident of that, 60% of Eurasia land mass. And in terms of the world population, it represents 40% of it. And when it comes to the global GDP, 30% is here. So Iran is also one of the countries because last year it became a permanent member. The last time that they met. All right, now let's move on to another grouping of countries. This grouping is actually also very important, and it's called the RCEP. What does it stand for? Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership Agreement, comprised of members with a world population of 15 members in total, the world population coming in at, 30%, 2.2 billion people, okay? So obviously a big grouping of countries in this particular block. The global GDP stands at second, and this is quite a bit since it's the largest grouping of countries, at $29.7 trillion. Okay? And therefore, it is no surprise that it holds the number one spot as being the world's largest trade bloc. That's right. And what is the most significant factor in all of these trading blocks, now that we've covered some of them? It's the fact that the U.S. is not a member. I repeat, not a member, which shows how the U.S. has, in some ways, isolated itself on the world stage when it comes to trade. Okay, let's bring back our guest for Q&A here. We have Glenn Deason, professor of international relations at the University of Southeastern Norway, rejoining us. Glenn Deason, welcome back. Iran, holding the world's second largest gas reserves, has applied for membership at the BRICS group of countries, along with Argentina. China has said that it wants other emerging economies to actually join this bloc, which was exclusively between the five countries, and would like to shape the BRICS agenda in line with its China-centric initiatives. No surprise there. Do you think Western policies and other systems emanating from the West have failed when it comes to why BRICS is now emerging so powerfully?
Well, yes, it has. I mean, if you look through history, liberal economic systems, so opening up trade and the cooperation between states, tend to organize under economic hegemons, so dominant economies, because they take on the role to administer the global economy, you know, because they have the technologies, the industries, the infrastructure, you know, bank and dominant currencies, and they can set the standards. So what we usually see is that the economic hegemon is to have an interest in creating trust in such a system, which is centered around them. So that is kind of the incentive. The problem is a hegemon in decline. It becomes more and more likely to abuse this administrative position in the economy. So it weaponizes this control over the economy to strike down against adversaries, to protect its declining position.
All right, let's have Kindo Zhu join us. He's a political analyst who joins us from Beijing in China. Kindo Zhu, welcome back. BRICS accounting for more than 40% of the world population and 26% of the global economy. You have other alliances also, such as the EAEU or RCEP in your part of the world, and also taking a look at the SCO, of which China is a major member of those alliances. But let's focus on BRICS in terms of its contribution. Countries like Russia and Brazil, each accounting for about 7%, along with the contributions made by the other countries, was once dismissed as a grouping, but now it has come back, and it is said to stand as a bulwark against the U.S. and the West. Do you see it that way?
Well, I think if you look at the past several years, you know, since the start, of the Trump regime, 2016, Trump launched the trade war, tech war, and a series of wars, quote unquote, not only against China, but also against the Europeans and even its close neighbors like Canada and Mexico. So in that sense, the U.S. has adopted a policy that is prioritize its domestic interests. Of course, U.S. has always been doing that, including this current U.S. government under Biden, for example. But for Trump, it's more standing out about the U.S., America First policy. In that sense, that's a huge, huge devastation to the global trade, the multipolar, multilateral system. For example, the WTO, the U.S. has more or less paralyzed this very important multilateral trade organization, and the U.S. has imposed the tariffs even today. We are talking about billions and billions of Chinese goods. This is a huge blow to this globalization.
The expanding influence of BRICS has encouraged other nations to join the economic and political bloc. Iran and Argentina have both applied for memberships. China has actually encouraged other countries, especially emerging nations, to join the bloc. In the case of Iran, it holds the world's second largest gas reserves. Its membership in BRICS would result in added values for both sides.
Leaders and foreign ministers reached a very important consensus to start promoting the discussions on the membership expansion issue. And we will start to identify the criteria and the principles, guidelines on this issue. China's intention is to keep it open, and we'd like to see that new members can come in. I do not have a timeline for this, but it's really based on the consensus of all BRICS countries.
BRICS countries have agreed that it is important to step up cooperation with other emerging markets and developing countries in order to improve the representation of the BRICS mechanism and make it loudly heard on major international issues. This will help to better rise up to challenges and to uphold the interests of emerging markets and developing countries.
منفتح وليس مغلق بأن لا يكون هناك تأثير سياسي على الاقتصاد بشكل مباشر.
Iran's potential membership to the BRICS group would be a severe blow to U.S. attempts to isolate Iran ever since the victory of the Islamic Republic. Washington has tried to ostracize Iran through various ways, including sanctions and threats. Iran has recently made great leaps in its foreign policy. It is now a member of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization and has applied for membership to the Eurasia Economic Union. Both of them are non-U.S.-led organizations that seek to counter the hegemony of the West. BRICS members, along with countries like Argentina and Iran, are a group of emerging economies that can evolve as an engine of global growth, which means that Western countries will be left behind as a result.
When it comes to the recent BRICS meeting, the role that this grouping plays in the world economy was highlighted again. But there was something very different about what this grouping represented as reflected through what the Chinese president said. What was another key highlight from Xi's four-point proposal on pursuing high-quality development of BRICS cooperation? These three were pretty significant. First, he said we need to speak out for equity and justice, to encourage the international community to practice true multilateralism, urging the world to reject the Cold War mentality and block confrontation, oppose unilateral sanctions, and abuse of sanctions. The need to pool strength for economic recovery, to step up macro policy coordination, to keep industrial and supply chains secure and unclogged, to build an open world economy, and to forestall and diffuse major risks and challenges in global development. And finally, to advocate sustainable and people-centered development, invest more in poverty alleviation, food, education, health, and so on, and promote the implementation of the UN's 2030 Agenda for Sustainable Development. China has made it a point to set the stage in many of the previous topics discussed, and therefore it is no surprise that its governance model is what he believes is a successful one, which is non-Western.
The one impressed me most is the last few sentences made by President Xi, the emphasis of mutual benefit, cooperation, and win-win situation among the BRIC countries. This is very important because now the world is suffering because a BRIC country is trying to maintain its superpower.
This entry explains this fully. At BRICS Summit, China set stage to tout its governance model, where the bloc of emerging economies were praised for promoting non-Western styles, forms, and principles. It went on to say that boosting multilateral cooperation with non-Western styles, forms, and principle is of utmost importance, stressing the importance of the bloc at a time when the U.S. is pulling its Western allies to rebel against globalization.
As a developing country, Thailand looks forward to cooperating with BRICS countries, especially in terms of science and technology transfer and cooperation, technical training. I think BRICS has been very important in helping to promote cooperation, especially among emerging and developing countries.
And that does it for my segment.
In today's program, we brought you the relevance of BRICS, and I think we've done okay in terms of telling you how big a bloc that is, along with the other trading blocs and alliances, which show how much the world is shifting in terms of those alliances getting closer and doing trade amongst themselves. And we did mention that these blocs do not have the U.S. as a member, but there's a bigger reason for that, and that is the way that the U.S. has carried itself in its foreign policy endeavors. Sanctions to be one of them, of which the Chinese president, Xi Jinping, said that that is just counterproductive, especially for the world economy to grow, preventing that from happening. That is the main focus in what I want to leave you with, because obviously the U.S. is being left behind when it comes to the economics of the world and how it's preventing that to progress. That does it for this edition of the program. It was great having you with us. From Mikavi Tahwe, it's goodbye until next time.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, close up, Iran.
Hello. I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. Airports are interesting places, in my view, especially when your flight is delayed. I am now sitting in the airport's coffee shop, drinking my tea and watching people coming and going. My destination is Khuzestan province, the city of Shush. I'm going to visit Shush Castle. Surely it will be an exciting trip. Stay with me. Shush Castle is a castle which was built on a historical hill in Shush by the French during the Qajarid era. This castle was constructed in 1898 by French archaeologist Jean-Jacques de Morgan as a secure base for archaeological exploration and excavation. The structure was built with the help of local Des Folies craftsmen in European-style architecture. It was constructed with bricks taken from two other archaeological sites, the Achaemenid Darius Castle, that is Apadana Palace in Shush, and the Elamite Choghazanbil Ziggurat. Jacques de Morgan led the French archaeologist team in Iran and in Shush for 15 years, from 1897 to 1912. This team found two important historical relics in its excavations, including a cuneiform tablet inscribed with the code of Hammurabi and the statue of Napirasu. I am now in the beautiful city of Shush, Shush Castle, which is also known as De Morgan Castle, is located near Daniel Nabi Shrine. I don't have a long way to the castle, and I'd better walk this way and enjoy the scenery. I am now in the area of Shush Castle. This structure is magnificent. The plan of this castle is very similar to the medieval castles and has a trapezoid shape. This castle has 2 yards. In order to reach the first yard, I have to walk up these stairs. Well, there is a small corridor. And here we have the first yard. In this yard, there are the archaeological tools of the French archaeologists. The first yard is almost small and has way to the second yard with several stairs. Oh, thank God, there are not so many stairs. And this is the second yard. What a big yard. Oh, everywhere, even the floor, is covered with bricks. Walking on these bricks gives me a nice feeling. This yard is surrounded by several chambers. Let's see inside them. Thank you. I am now in one of the chambers of Shush Castle. The walls have paintings in green color around the entrance door. There are paintings of turtles. And on this wall, there is the painting of a large tree with stems and roots entangled. And here we can enter another chamber. And it's interesting to note that around the entrance of this chamber has the paintings of turtles. This chamber, like the first one, is empty. However, it has many different paintings on its walls, such as the painting of camel, palm tree, ram, panda, and zebra. Of course, Shush Castle is not just these chambers. You have to visit this place yourself and see its beauties with your own eyes.
Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
America and the world would be far safer places if this outrageous spending was drastically cut and those funds redirected to moral investments in people, society, and planetary health, not war and weapons, says William Harting, author, in an article published under the heading, America's $1.4 trillion so-called national security budget makes us less safe, not more. Stay tuned for the second part of this article, please. The average taxpayer, no doubt, assumes that a government agency called the Department of Energy would be primarily concerned with developing new sources of energy, including ones that would reduce America's dependence on fossil fuels to help rein in the ravages of climate change. Unfortunately, that assumption couldn't be less true. Instead of spending the bulk of its time and money on energy research and development, more than 40% of the U.S. Department of Energy's budget for 2023 is slated to support the National Nuclear Security Administration, or NNSA, which manages the U.S. nuclear weapons program principally by maintaining and developing nuclear warheads. Work on other military activities like reactors for nuclear submarines pushes the defense share of the DOE budget even higher. The NNSA spreads its work across the U.S. with major locations in California, Missouri, Nevada, New Mexico, South Carolina, Tennessee, and Texas. Its proposed 2023 budget for nuclear weapons activities is $16.5 billion, part of a budget for defense-related projects of $29.8 billion. Amazingly, the NNSA's record of managing its programs may be even worse than the Pentagon's, with cost overruns of more than $28 billion during the last two decades. Many of its current projects, like a plan to build a new facility to produce plutonium pits, the devices that trigger the explosion of a hydrogen bomb, are unnecessary even under the current misguided nuclear weapons modernization plan. Nuclear budget, $29.8 billion, running in security tally, $815.6 billion. This catch-all category, pegged at $10.6 billion in 2023, includes the international activities of the FBI and payments to Central Intelligence Agency retirement funds, among other things. Defense-related activities, $10.6 billion. Running in security tally, $826.2 billion. Information about this country's 18 separate intelligence agencies is largely shielded from public view. Most members of Congress don't even have a staff that can access significant details on how intelligence funds are spent, making meaningful congressional oversight almost impossible. The only real data supplied with regard to the intelligence agencies is a top-line number, $67.1 billion proposed for 2023, a $5 billion increase over 2022. Most of the intelligence community's budget is believed to be hidden inside the Pentagon budget. So, in the interest of making a conservative estimate, intelligence spending is not included in our tally. Intelligence budget, $67.1 billion. Running in security tally still, $826.2 billion. America's post-9/11 wars have generated millions of veterans, many of whom have returned from battle with severe physical or psychological injuries. As a result, spending on veterans affairs has soared, reaching a proposed $301 billion in the 2023 budget plan. Research conducted for the Cost of War project at Brown University has determined that these costs will only grow, with more than $2 trillion needed just to take care of the veterans of the post-9/11 conflicts. Veterans Affairs budget, $301 billion, running in security tally, $1.127 trillion. The International Affairs budget includes non-military items like diplomacy at the State Department and economic aid through the Agency for International Development, critical but significantly underfunded parts of the U.S. national security strategy writ large. But even in this category, there are significant military-related activities in the form of programs that provide arms and training to foreign militaries and police forces. It's proposed that's the largest of these, the Foreign Military Financing Program, should receive $6 billion in 2023. Meanwhile, the total requested international affairs budget is $67.8 billion in 2023. International affairs budget, $67.8 billion, running in security tally, $1.195 trillion. After the 9/11 attacks, the Department of Homeland Security of the United States, or DHS, was established by combining a wide range of agencies, including the Federal Emergency Management Agency, the Transportation Security Agency, the U.S. Secret Service, Customs and Border Protection, and the Coast Guard. The proposed DHS budget for 2023 is $56.7 billion, more than one quarter of which goes to Customs and Border Protection as part of a militarized approach to addressing immigration into the United States. Homeland Security budget, $56.7 billion, running in security tally, $1.252 trillion. The national security state, as outlined so far, is responsible for about 26% of interest due on the U.S. debt, a total of $1.52 billion. Interest on the debt, $152 billion, running in security tally, $1.404 trillion. Spending $1.4 trillion to address a narrowly defined concept of national security should be considered budgetary malpractice on a scale so grand as to be almost unimaginable, especially at a time when the greatest risk to the safety of Americans and the rest of the world are not military in nature. After all, the COVID-19 pandemic has already taken the lives of more than 1 million Americans, while the fires, floods, and heat waves caused by climate change have impacted tens of millions more. Yet the administration's proposed allocation of $45 billion to address climate change in 2023 budget would be less than 6% of the Pentagon's proposed budget of $773 billion. And as noted, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention are slated to get just one-third of the proposed increase in the Pentagon spending between 2022 and 2023. Worse yet, attempts to raise spending significantly to address these urgent challenges, from President Biden's Build Back Better plan to the Green New Deal, are stalled in Congress. In a world where such dangers are only increasing, perhaps the best hope for launching a process that could sooner or later reverse such perverse priorities lies with grassroots organizing. Consider, for instance, the moral budget crafted by the Poor People's Campaign, which would cut Pentagon spending almost in half while refocusing on programs aimed at eliminating poverty, protecting the environment, and improving access to healthcare. If even part of such an agenda were achieved and the defense budget reined in, if not cut drastically, America and the world would be far safer places. Given the scale of the actual security problems we face, it's time to think big when it comes to potential solutions, while recognizing what Martin Luther King Jr. once described as the fierce urgency of now. Time is running short, and concerted action is imperative.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Apparently, senior officials inside the European Commission are not celebrating the news that Boris Johnson is to leave No. 10 Downing Street. There is a belief that his successor will still want to break key elements of the Brexit agreement relating to Northern Ireland. The EU accuses the British government of breaking international law by moving to scrap the Northern Ireland Protocol, which is designed to preserve peace in Ireland by preventing physical border checks. Senior EU lawmaker Guy Verhofstadt has tweeted, "Boris Johnson's reign ends in disgrace, just like his friend Donald Trump. The end of an era of transatlantic populism? Let's hope so. EU-UK relations suffered hugely with Johnson's choice of Brexit. Things can only get better." Analysts we have been speaking to are less optimistic. Members of the public in Brussels have been telling us what they think about Johnson's political demise.
I'm glad to see him gone. I don't think he was the cause of the problem between EU and UK, but he didn't help solve it.
I don't think the position on the Northern Ireland Protocol will change much. Unless there's a snap election and then, say, like, Labour... Yeah. Take over something. I don't think there'll be any change.
Former EU Brexit negotiator Michel Barnier has tweeted, "The departure of Boris Johnson opens a new page in relations with Britain. May it be more constructive, more respectful of commitments made, in particular regarding peace and stability in Northern Ireland, and more friendly with partners in the EU."
We asked the European Commission spokespeople if the EU's legal action against the British government over Northern Ireland might be paused now that Johnson is leaving the stage. They came back with a simple answer: no. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
A fresh controversy is building in a Labour-held borough in East London as an embattled Muslim MP fights for her career. Elected as Britain's first hijab-wearing MP in 2019, Absana Begum's career started off well under the former leader Jeremy Corbyn. However, since Keir Starmer took over in 2020, things took an ugly turn, as local members in the safe Labour seat allegedly turned against her. Things became so bad that Begum was recently hospitalised and taken off work sick, following what she claims is a sustained campaign of misogynistic abuse. Despite this, a trigger ballot has now been launched, which aims to bar her from standing in the next election, a move condemned by her allies in Parliament. A former Muslim Labour member believes this may be part of a larger plot by party leadership to remove an MP they just don't like.
Absana Begum was previously subjected to a smear campaign where she was maliciously accused by a Labour council of supposedly committing housing fraud, and she was found not guilty when she was taken to court. And so this is actually the second attempt to destroy her political career. The people going after her are determined to stop anti-imperialists and practicing Muslims from being involved in public life. It isn't simply the case that Keir Starmer is failing to act. I believe that it's highly likely that Keir Starmer's office is directing this campaign of abuse, harassment and vilification against Absana Begum. And this is part of a broader Islamophobic anti-socialist strategy to rid the Labour Party of anyone who previously supported Jeremy Corbyn and, frankly, to rid the party of practicing Muslims.
The Labour Party hasn't commented on the case so far. Press TV's attempts to reach Begum for further comment was also unsuccessful.
Starmer has been condemned by various Labour groups over conducting so-called purges of left-wing members who joined the party under Corbyn. Muslims as well feel very persecuted over their views on issues such as criticism of Israel and Palestine solidarity. The fact that Labour's first ever hijab-wearing MP also feels abused will likely deepen Muslim resentment in the party going forward. Robert Carter, London.
After 2 years of waiting for the Hajj, caravans of pilgrims and lovers of the sacred house of God have converged on Mecca. Nearly 40,000 Iranian pilgrims were also among the 850,000 foreign pilgrims who have visited Saudi Arabia for 2022 Hajj. Many of them have been waiting for years for their turn.
After 17 years of waiting, I was able to visit this holy place, and I hope all Iranians could one day travel to this sacred land.
I've traveled to Mecca after 15 years of waiting, and I hope all Muslims' wishes come true.
Figures show some 5.8 million Iranians are on a waiting list for traveling to Saudi Arabia to perform Hajj, most of them for over a decade. And this year, Saudi-imposed restrictions on the Hajj pilgrimage have dealt a blow to many Iranians' hopes. Ministry of Hajj and Umrah barred pilgrims under the age of 65 from participating in the Hajj. Also, pilgrims must be fully vaccinated.